Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And we want to continually remind you to join in the prayer circle that we have indicated on Red State Talk Radio podcast page. And on top of that, if you're going to create one, you want to have your own local, then just let us, if you want to open it up, just let us know if you want to do that. And because we do believe in the power of prayer, and we want to continue to help educate you so that we can actually be more efficacious, both in our prayers and our efforts. Anywho, as we kind of dive into the content, and as we were covering, I believe we're going through the bank debates, the debates on the bank, the national bank, debate over the national bank. And I think we were just covering, I think, Ames Fisher. As a matter of fact, welcome back, Tammy and Sean, and help me out here. I believe, Tammy, you completed the very last comments from Ames Fisher yesterday, right? Mm-hmm. When we were ending. That's what I thought. So we're literally on the Thomas Jefferson side. Now, we go through this, folks, because you need to understand that Madison was trying, because we clearly show in the debates, that Madison was trying to hold the line. He was trying to pull back Congress from, you know, breaking through the paradigm of a limited and defined government. Now, what they didn't do was they didn't just go around and use a fairy wand and touched everything and said, we now claim everything. This has been a very incremental and methodical process where they would try to do things, and if they got away with it, great. If they didn't get away with it, they'd try it again later. A good case in point, and we'll get to it as a part of the content before the end of the year, is the three presidential vetoes of the Department of Transportation. We have a really good video on this, 7 minutes long. 7 minutes long, you'll get that smart on how Congress was trying to push bills through, and the presidents were vetoing them, saying, hey, you don't have this power to do this. We can't do it. So as Madison pointed to the ratification debate, saying we have to live within the parameters is the way this Constitution was sold, period. That's what we have to do. We can't redefine it. We don't have that authority. What you're doing is basically assuming powers as not as a representative body that is governed by the powers granted. You're just deciding, hey, if we all agree, we can do it. That is where we are today in every state legislature, in every town council, in every county legislative group, as supervisors, commissioners, whatever you call it, the county level. Everybody's doing it. Well, shoot, everybody else is doing it. Why can't we? And that is not a winning solution. That is not the way we're going to preserve our liberty. It's the way they can get, ingratiate themselves. It's the way they can, get benefits and opportunities for themselves by doing the bidding for people that are out to destroy us. So this played out in Congress as this argument between you have a limited defined, powers, and you can only do these things. You can't do this. Now, Jefferson's going to pipe in, and then Hamilton is going to pipe in last. And I think by the time we get through this content, you will see the foundation. This is the foundation of how Hamilton won the tug of war. Now, Sean, remember we read, or you actually read, Thomas Jefferson's account of the compromise. Thomas Jefferson was an agent in assisting Hamilton in pulling Congress sideways. And Madison was still trying to pull Congress back. He said, I may not be so vigorous, but I am not going to change my position. He just said he won't be as vigorous as he was. but he still provided the lucid argument that was very, very clear that they could not do this based on the contemporary definitions provided during the ratification debates. They could not do this. So we're going to now dive into Thomas Jefferson's statements. And as a matter of fact, it's not too long. It's about 2 pages. And so we'll cover this, and then we're going to cover Alexander Hamilton. Now, Alexander Hamilton was probably even less than Thomas Jefferson. And I say that because, well, actually, hold on here. As I look at Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson is about a half a page, and Alexander Hamilton is of the remaining page and a half. So Thomas Jefferson is really being short and concise and saying you can't do this, but let's hear what he says. So go ahead.
Which document?
Now, this is the debate over the National Bank.
Okay.
And based on the navigation pane or the navigation screen, you just click on the Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson. It'll take you to the top of the 7th page, where it basically talks about Thomas Jefferson, and he references the 12th Amendment, and it's spelt out in Roman numerals, and so it kind of throws people off. It's, anyway, that hopefully, and the 12th Amendment, by the way, is the 10th Amendment.
Right.
Okay, just because some people don't understand that when the amendments went out, they hadn't been ratified basically yet. If you look at the date here, this is February 15th. The Bill of Rights didn't get ratified until December 15th, the same year. So they were still waiting for these to come back out of the, all 12 amendments that were sent out as the Bill of Rights. And it, what ultimately came back were 10 were ratified. And the first two were not ratified. Just to throw some more confusion into it, the first two weren't ratified. So from the 2nd to the 12th, all jumped up, you know, to the 1st to the 10th. And the other two just kind of fell out, and then they, as they get adopted or as they get ratified, they are then amended, which is why the 2nd Amendment became the 27th Amendment, because it was ratified in 1992. Okay, so keeping all this stuff straight isn't the easiest, but it's not hard. If you force yourself to keep the connections, it just falls into place. So anyway, go ahead and read Thomas Jefferson's response or his argument. Go ahead.
I consider the foundation of the Constitution as laid on this ground, that all powers not delegated to the U.S. by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states or to the people. 12th Amendment. To take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power no longer susceptible of any definition. The incorporation of a bank and other powers assumed by this bill have not, in my opinion, been delegated to the United States by the Constitution. They are not among the powers specially enumerated, nor are they within either of the general phrases, which are the two following. The second general phrase is to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution the enumerated powers, but they can all be carried into execution without a bank. A bank, therefore, is not necessary and consequently not authorized by this phrase. It has been much urged that a bank will give great facility or convenience in the collection of taxes. Suppose this were true, yet the Constitution allows only the means which are necessary, not those which are merely convenient for effecting the enumerated powers. If such a latitude of construction be allowed to this phrase as to give any non-enumerated power, it will go to everyone, for there is no one which ingenuity may not torture into a convenience. In some way or other, to someone of so long a list of enumerated powers, it would swallow up all the delegated powers and reduce the whole to one phrase as before observed. Therefore, it was the Constitution restrained them to the necessary means, that is to say, to those means which outwit which the grant of power would be nugatory.
Okay, thank you. All right, so pretty short, concise, and he kind of lays it out that, you know, look, it's not granted, and opening this door means that you're going to come back and you're going to start going sideways in every direction. That isn't, that's not some, you know, what I'll call some heavenly prophecy. Empirical data has only proven this. Empirical data has always proven that when somebody, when men have successfully been able to breach or use an argument to create an advantage for themselves, they will quickly be back on that same argument to do the next one, to the next one, to the next one. So, as we're looking, I mean, this is the very beginning of the Republic. And I believe, because I've asked myself, why is it? I couldn't fathom why Jefferson and Madison, and I guess every year I might come around to this realization that they actually took an active role in kind of cheering the pull or the pushing of the Assumption Act. The Assumption Act actually incorporated the Bank Act when it finally hit the table, because that's what we read, you know, prior to this document. And in the Assumption Act, it was creating a bank. It was actually creating the registries, how much money was going to go around, the type of products, and so forth. And so as we look at this debate, and so there's a bill that we're going to get into after this, and I believe that that bill itself is the establishment of that Bank Act that creates that bank. I will kind of pull that up, but while we go through Hamilton's argument, because that's the next one here, and these are all excerpts out of the congressional record. So it's not that this isn't a part of the document. This was an excerpt that the Library of Congress, because if you actually it's the foundersarchive.gov. So it's a section of the Library of Congress where they basically said, here are the founders speaking, you know, in this debate, this debate, this debate. So it helps you kind of see what they were saying in these arguments. So, Tammy, go ahead and knock out Alexander Hamilton's opinion in this debate. Now, keep in mind, he's the Secretary of Treasury. Go ahead.
Okay. The Secretary of Treasury, having perused with attention the papers containing the opinions of the Secretary of State and the Attorney General concerning the constitutionality of the bill for establishing the National Bank, proceeds, according to the order of the President, to submit the reasons which have induced him to entertain a different opinion. The first of these arguments is that the foundation of the Constitution is laid on this ground, that all powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited to it by the states are reserved to the states or to the people. Whence it is meant to be inferred that Congress can in no case exercise any power not included in those enumerated in the Constitution, and it is affirmed that the power of erecting a corporation is not included in any of the enumerated powers. To this mode of reasoning respecting the right of employing all the means requisite to the execution of the specified powers of the government, it is objected that none but necessary and proper means are to be employed, and the Secretary of State maintains that no means are to be considered as necessary but those without which the grant of the power would be nugatory. Nay, so far does he go in this restrictive interpretation of the word as even to make the case of necessity, which shall warrant the constitutional exercise of a power, to depend on casual and temporary circumstances, an idea which alone refutes the construction. The expediency of exercising a particular power at a particular time must indeed depend on circumstances, but the constitutional right of exercising it must be uniform and invariable, the same today as tomorrow. It is essential to the being of the national government that so erroneous a conception of the meaning of the word necessary should be exploded. It is certain that neither the grammatical nor popular sense of the term requires that construction.
Keep going.
According to both, necessary often means no more than needful, requisite, incidental, useful, or conducive to. It is a common mode of expression to say that it is necessary for a government or a person to do this or that thing when nothing more is intended or understood. But that in the interests of the government or person require or will be promoted by doing, by the doing of this or that thing. The imagination can be at no loss for exemplifications of the use of the word in this sense.
Okay, so right there, he uses this term, actually what he's doing, according to both necessary, often means no more than needful, requisite, incidental, useful, or conducive. So what he's doing is he's redefining a clause that was actually defined in the ratification base, as if Congress has this ability to look at something and say, well, you know, how was this defined? Well, technically, going back to what Madison stated, we have to go by how it was defined in the debates. Is Hamilton doing that? No. He is actually opening the door and saying, well, let's redefine it now. Let's look at it and let's look at how it's to be defined. And we'll decide now. No. The states basically galvanize those definitions by accepting them the way they were presented, not the way that they anticipated Congress would actually start interpreting, because if they would have fell into that camp, they would have actually gone down the anti-federalist path of saying, hey, they're going to try to redefine this, and when they do, they're going to take this latitude, therefore we're going to reject this. In other words, the Constitution would have been rejected had this concept that Congress would actually go down this path of doing this. Again, the reason why the Constitution was actually ratified was because the Federalists said if they did that, they would be violating their oath and violating the Constitution, which is exactly what Hamilton is doing right here, because he's literally redefining something that was galvanized in the process of ratifying the compact. Go ahead, finish the rest. Thank you.
Okay. And it is the true one in which it is to be understood as used in the Constitution. The whole turn of the clause containing it indicates that it was the intent of the Federal Convention by that clause to give a liberal latitude to the exercise of the specified powers. The expressions have peculiar comprehensiveness. They are to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by the Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. To understand the word as the Secretary of State does would be to depart from its obvious and popular sense and to give it a restrictive operation, an idea never before entertained. It would be to give it the same force as if the word absolutely or indispensably had been prefixed to it.
Okay, so if you stop right there. Up towards the top of what you just read, Hamilton does another dirty deed. What he says here is the whole turn of the clause containing it indicates that it was the intent of the Federal Convention by that clause to give liberal latitude to the exercise of the specified powers. Well, hold on here. The convention itself wasn't in play. What's in play, because the convention decided on what the language would be going into it, but how that language was to be understood had nothing to do with the convention. The language that was explaining it was what was provided in the ratification debates. So again, he's actually bypassing again the ratification debates and going, well, hey, this is how we discussed it in the convention. It's almost like he's re-ratifying the Constitution every step he's going, bypassing the actual legal accepted terms and definitions as at the part and time of ratification. So folks, this is so big of a deal. it's almost like you making a contract with somebody, and then all of a sudden they're redefining it left and right, and what you have left is just shredded. You have no semblance of what you thought you had when you agreed and signed that with all of these appended stipulations, terms, and definitions. Because in legal sense, when a contract is in the process of being accepted, those terms that are being provided, the definitions, the stipulations, they become legally binding. This is why any person that's buying a car, selling something, and something is stipulated at that point in time, and it is agreed to, and hands are shaken, and the contracts are signed, those things, if they aren't written down, then you can have a problem proving them. But if you wrote them down that at the time of ratification, this is how it was stipulated, then that becomes legally binding, just like if a dealership promised that they were going to wash and wax your car once a week for every week that you own that car that you just bought from them. That is a legally binding stipulation if they assert it. You just have to make sure it's written down. Here is the kicker. The ratification debates were written down. Period. They were written down, and they're very, very clear as to how they were defining these artifacts or these objects within the Constitution. So go ahead, and I think, what is there, about two paragraphs. Let's go and finish this up. Thanks.
Okay. Such a construction would beget endless uncertainty and embarrassment. The cases must be palpable and extreme in which it could be pronounced with certainty that a measure was absolutely necessary, or one without which the exercise of a given power would be nugatory. There are few measures of any government which would stand so severe a test. To insist upon it would be to make the criterion of the exercise of any implied power a case of extreme necessity, which is rather a rule to justify the overleaping of the bounds of constitutional authority than to govern the ordinary exercise of it. The degree in which a measure is necessary can never be a test of the legal right to adopt it. That must ever be matter of opinion and can only be a test of expediency. The relation between the measure and the end, between the nature of the mean employed towards the execution of the power and the object of that power, must be the criterion of constitutionality, not the more or less of necessity or utility.
Okay, thank you. So now what we're going to get into, and let me look at the source for this. Okay, so this is Founders Archive as well. And the next document that we have, this kind of wraps up that debate. And this is cherry picking, right? This is cherry picking out of the debate. And so when we go into this next document, which I'll give you guys time to pull it up, it is the bank bill. This is really not the language out of Congress, but this is the language that they put into the Founders online archive, right? The bank bill. And they actually go back and forth kind of between Madison's arguments and so forth. This is, I think, the Senate's view on this, as they're kind of looking at, you know, how it's been presented and how it's moved through the House up to them. And so I don't want to go through all of this, but there are some key points that are worthwhile at the very top end of this, where it kind of sets the stage. Now, Madison is consistent. That's one thing you gotta love this man. Here's the guy that prior to the Constitution Convention worked arduously in getting the states to actually create this convention. Now, I'm going to give you a little background, but we're going into break. So to finish the background, I need to kind of let the break go through. So please, wait until I come back. I want to finish the background on really what Madison went through, because I want you to understand the level of integrity of this man, of how he was really a part of the solution and not some egomaniac like we're dealing with Hamilton. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so what we're going to kind of read, because I want you to get a taste of this, but before we do, let me give you the background on Hamilton, not Hamilton, but on Madison. So it was clear that the Articles of Confederation were defunct. The Union was going to die. As a matter of fact, the states were going to be kind of left in the winds, and those states that didn't pay their debt were going to be ripe. They were going to probably be the first states to be attacked, or all of them collectively would be attacked because by guilt by association. Putting all that aside, and oh, by the way, what was happening right now in 1790? Because it was in 1787 when Madison was making this hard appeal. As a matter of fact, 1786, with others in the Annapolis Convention, they were basically saying, we need a constitutional convention to rewrite or to basically create a fix to the Articles of Confederation. And ultimately, that's exactly what they did. They stayed within their scope. They did exactly as described and as asked to do. So prior to the convention, as Annapolis was being, I will just say, endorsed by Continental Congress, going out to the state, Madison had two things he was working on arduously. One, he was creating a plan of how to create a better government out of the Articles of Confederation. So he basically was the guy that crafted the separation of the magistrate into an executive, a legislative, and a judiciary. Now, the process, because when we went through this in the Constitutional Convention, we kind of provided this view of the Virginia Plan, which was Madison's plan. The process of selecting the Senate, the higher chamber of the legislative body, they were going to be selected out of the basic legislative body. In other words, the legislatures were going to select their own senators. And in so doing, that was kind of create this, I'll call it, the way the small states viewed it. They felt that everything was being bolstered to have the larger states with more power, that the small states just saw this as a huge threat to their sovereignty, that they would just be swallowed up. But nonetheless, Madison created this plan, and he created the fundamental design of what the Constitution became, built off of that. So the point is here's a guy that went in there and his plan was rejected. The framework was basically accepted, but it was completely revamped. And Roger Sherman was the guy that actually, kind of blew up the legislative to actually become a representative body, or two representative bodies that represented sovereigns, instead of two classes, much like Parliament. Because what Madison was presenting was there you would have a House of Commons and then a House of Lords, where instead of the Senate being the Lords, it would be, the who's who selected by the House. The House would, decide who would sit in that Senate, not the people or the Lords or an aristocracy. So it was all kind of it was laid out in a way that, you know, I would think that anybody that had pride in authorship would have actually, you know, took it personal. Most people I know, when they come in with a plan and they go, hey, you know, here's my plan. And, oh, well, you rejected my plan. And they just kind of want to take their ball and go home. That's common. But Madison didn't do that. And as a matter of fact, as people started making changes, he didn't cling to his paradigm. He let it go because the group agreed that this would be better. And 9 times out of 10, I guess Madison felt that same way. I believe that when you really go through his notes, every once in a while you will see his biases or his opinions kind of color his comments about what somebody said about him or his idea or what have you. But nevertheless, as the Constitutional Convention went through and it ended with the final design, Madison wasn't, you know, constantly going back to, you know, well, it should have been like this. Madison was the champion of that final design and maintaining that. Not only maintaining the final design from the convention, but maintaining how it was sold to the states. In other words, the integrity of this man is so marginalized. And it's because of him, we actually have this accurate picture of what our government really should be because of the quality of this man's character. Now, I've looked and I've seen other framers. Now, Roger Sherman is one I guess I should probably spend more time, because here's a guy that actually was involved in a lot of different things, from the Declaration of Independence through the Convention of States, or I should say through the Constitutional Convention and the ratification debates. So Roger Sherman had spent a lot of time in helping evolve this government. So I think that there's merit in looking at that man. But he wasn't necessarily, you know, that guy in Congress to stand up and hold the line. It was Madison every time pulling on Congress to stay within the defined framework that was established in those ratification debates, which is why we proved to you twice now. He was living on that. He was living on the context of how it was defined. We've got other cases, as a matter of fact, 3 times now, because I got to count the cod fishery bounties. So the cod fishery bounties, the Assumption Act, and now the Bank Act, where he's pointing to, hey, we have to live within these defined parameters of the ratification debates. So all that being said, folks, that is one man that held the line. He consistently held the line to the day he died. There's never been, and I'm yet to have anybody prove to me that Madison actually, you know, looked over and says, you know what, let's use the Federalist Papers. He never did that. And as a matter of fact, the guy that did do that is the guy that actually had no scruples. He's the guy that actually built and put the poison in the Federalist Papers so that the judiciary could get out of its confines under the Constitution and ingratiate itself to be able to actually become a participant, not only a participant in tyranny, but become the leader in tyranny of the federal government. And which is why today, this goes back to, you know, prior to the show, I've been kind of lamenting, we've been talking a lot about the fact that we have so many legislators, so many people, Americans. I see this in social media. I see all sorts of, these people that are pretentious. There's these voices that are considered leaders. And I could easily say, and I will say, Charlie Kirk, because I've picked on him before, Candace Owens, Charlie Tucker. I don't care whoever it is. They never place accurate context of the Constitution, never. And as a matter of fact, they all accept, oh, well, the judiciary has these powers. This goes down a level of conspiracy that is just hard. I mean, how many people do you know that finally feel vindicated that, you know, we're finally getting exposed that those are chemtrails? That the vaccinations were out to design to kill us, to change us. All of these different conspiracies that have in modern day been basically laid out, And I'm just finding it just fascinating how nobody has gotten to the point where they're challenging the baked-in, there's not enough, I'll just say this, there's not enough patriots that are challenging the baked-in definitions that the court can create law, that the court is the final arbiter. These redefining of our government, this reshaping of our government into a judiciary form of government is an abomination. We're here to help you actually see what happened and why it happened. And I'm here to tell you that Madison was trying to hold the line when Hamilton had in his back pocket access to money, access to affluence, and access to basically tempt and convince people to go along with the redefining and the remodeling of this government. And, you know, we see we see the progressive entertainment industry basically regaling this man and applauding and, you know, accolades in his play Hamilton and so forth. Here is the guy that his actions, and as a matter of fact, one of the things we haven't done, but it's worth going through Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. And look at exactly how Hamilton stood up in the convention after everybody presented their plans, and he was just livid. He wasn't happy with anything they were doing. He wanted to create a monarchical dictatorship or something very similar to the British monarchical theocracy here in America. Now, he's a godless man, so I don't think he cared about the theocracy side, but he wanted to see a king. He didn't want to see a president with four terms. He wanted to see a permanent executive. He wanted to see a government similar to what was in Europe. And when he was done, basically, you know, I'll just say haranguing those members or those delegates in the Constitutional Convention, he walked out, got on his horse, and went to New York because he had other things to do, and he just aired his differences and said, you know, you guys are a bunch of idiots, this is what you should be doing, and then left. That was Hamilton. So you can't be surprised that Hamilton was a two-face. He just showed in the convention what that alternate face really was. But when it came back to, well, okay, this is what we're getting, then I will go ahead and subvert this by using the Federalist Papers. I'll get get Madison involved in this so it'll seem like it's, you know, it's irrefutable or it can't be impugned because we got his name on these things. And he buried, and what he ended up doing with those last eight papers is how he poisoned our government and the Constitution. And so hopefully, folks, you can start seeing these things, and hopefully when I'm done with this last article, or not the last article, this next article, and the poisonous pill, the Federalist Papers being the poisonous pill to the Constitution, that's the name of the article, you're going to actually be able to share this, because as I've said before, if you can destroy the argument that gave the judiciary the footings that it has, it knocks it back down into the framework where it belongs so that it can't create law, so it can't actually move agendas. It has to rule on law and fact. That the judiciary was literally an impotent office that was only to be the referee to ensure that the Constitution was being followed, not by bending the law and twisting and perverting and so forth. So let me get out of this rat hole. And let's get into, I believe, the bank bill, right? I mean, we just wrapped up, right, Tammy? Right, Sean? Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry, guys, for ranting. But what we want to do out of this bank bill, because you can kind of go to the founders' page on the Library of Congress, because the links are in all of my documents. I give you that link so you can go and look at it. But what we want to do is kind of read the very first few pages. Let me see. We want to go down to the end of page 3. So this is kind of somebody editorializing and putting information together out of what they've read out of the different documents. And so this is giving you some insight as to how the Senate members of the Senate were looking at what played out in the House of Representatives, because they refer to Madison as J.M. They refer to Eldridge Gerry as Gary. There's a Lawrence and so forth. So if you kind of look at who these people were, you know, I'm just kind of giving you the obvious. Ames was Ames. So let's do this. Who read last? I think Sean, or was it Tammy?
No, it was Tammy.
Okay. So, Sean, go ahead and pick up the Senate bill to incorporate subscribers to the bank. Let's read that. What we want to do is read that. We read these things by paragraph through the three pages. Now, when we get into the bottom of the second and third page, a kind of little sentence here, sentence there, so we'll try to break it down to a groups of sentences or something. But anyway, let's start with that first paragraph. Thank you.
The Senate bill to incorporate subscribers to the Bank of the United States was read in the House on 21 January. It came before the Committee of the Whole on 31 January, was read by paragraphs, and reported to the House without amendment. After a third reading, the House on 1 February proceeded to the question on the passage of the bill. Smith, South Carolina, protesting that the bill had been taken up rather unexpectedly yesterday, moved that it be recommitted to the Committee of the Whole for the purpose of making amendments. Lawrence and Gerry declared that those who wished to make changes should have brought them forward the previous day. J.M. replied, at this moment, it was not of importance to determine how it has happened that the objections which several gentlemen now say they have to offer against the bill were not made at the proper time. It is sufficient for them if the candor of the House should lead them to now recommit the bill, that in the Committee of the Whole they may have the opportunity to offer their objections. Ames remarked that it was absurd to go into a Committee of the Whole to determine whether the bill is constitutional or not, but J.M. insisted that there was the greatest propriety in discussing a constitutional question in the Committee of the Whole. The motion for recommitment was defeated 34-23, and the main question resumed on 2 February, Gazette of the U.S., 2 and 19 February, 1791.
Okay.
General Advertiser, 5th February, 1791.
Okay, great. So what we're looking at is they pulled a quick one. They were actually, you know, apparently people weren't paying attention in the body of the whole. And next thing you know, they're trying to move this bill forward out and get it out to, you know, to the Senate for signature, because I think they were still in the House. When they talk about the body of the whole, that's usually the House, not because the House and Senate function separately. They never vote together. They always vote, and it passes from one and it goes to the next. Therefore, Ames, you can tell Ames was doing everything he could to maintain the dirty deed. Okay, you caught us, but it's too late now. And Madison, and, you know, this is very early on, but, you know, 2 years into working in Congress, but he had that much weight to be able to pull this thing back to say, we're going to reexamine this. There's obviously sufficient cause for pulling this thing back. So go ahead, Tammy, and let's pick it up with the next paragraph.
Mr. Madison began with a general review of the advantages and disadvantages of banks. The former, he stated, consist in, first, the aid they afford to merchants who can thereby push their mercantile operations farther with the same capital. Second, the aid to merchants in paying punctually the customs. Third, aid to the government in complying punctually with its engagements when deficiencies or delays happen in the revenue. Fourth, in diminishing usury. Fifth, in saving the wear of the gold and silver kept in the vaults and represented by notes. Sixth, in facilitating occasional remittances from different places where notes happen to circulate. The effect of the proposed bank in raising the value of stock, he thought, had been greatly overrated. It would no doubt raise that of the stock subscribed into the bank, but could have little effect on stock in general, as the interest on it would remain the same and the quantity taken out of the market would be replaced by bank stock.
Okay, so he's laying out, you know, these points. And go ahead, Sean, and pick up the next paragraph. Okay, so actually, Madison was covering the advantages, what he thought, and he was kind of giving some, I'll just say, some colored commentary that he wasn't sure that the stock was really going to maintain or appreciate or what have you. But here's the disadvantages. Go ahead.
Could you remind me where we are again?
Oh, yeah. The principal disadvantages consisted in first banishing. We're on the bank bill.
No, I know we're on the bank bill. I seem to have lost my place.
Yeah, it's the last paragraph on page one. The principle of disadvantage.
Oh, okay. You're right. I am in the wrong. I was in the wrong document.
Oh, okay.
The principal disadvantages consisted in first banishing the precious metals by substituting another medium to perform their office. This effect was inevitable. It was admitted by the most enlightened patrons of banks, particularly by Smith on The Wealth of Nations. The common answer to the objection was that the money banished was only in exchange for something equally valuable that would be imported in return. He admitted that the weight of this observation in general, but doubted whether, in the present habits of this country, the returns would not be in articles of no permanent use to it. Second, exposing the public and individuals to all the evils of a run on the bank, which would be particularly calamitous in so great a country as this, and might happen from various causes, as false rumors, bad management of the institution, and unfavorable balance of trade from short crops, etc.
Right. So he's actually labeled out it, or he listed a run on the bank, that the nation would be susceptible to a run on the bank, because the bank, this is not a treasury. This is a bank creating products that would actually make itself vulnerable for people to come in and make the perception that there's all sorts of investments coming in, and then those drop out. There is a whole bunch of disadvantages, but bottom line, we're not talking about, you know, what most people would think a national bank would do. Well, it would take on the debt, and it would pay the debt off. It would take in revenue of taxes and use that revenue to pay that debt off and service the government and so forth. No, this is literally a bank creating bonds and so forth, commercial products. So when we look further down the road, when Madison created his charter, I really question whether he actually created bonds or if he just created a mechanism to taking on debt, because he didn't have another way of doing it. You know, unfortunately, when somebody goes through, you know, from point A to point B in the snow, and I don't know, Tammy probably doesn't understand this because they don't get a lot of snow out there in Wyoming, but when, you know, you're out at the house and there's some shed or some thing that you need to go to, the first person that goes out there in the deep snow, they kind of carve a trail. And if they do a really good job, then you've got a clear path that, you know, makes it easier and easier to get out to that shed, get out to that barn, what have you. It works that way, right, Tammy? So you want to make sure that that first person out isn't meandering all across the yard, you know, and the property, to, you know, to checking on, how's the creek look? And, you know, is this log covered by snow? Because if they meander, then, you know, what the heck did you do? We were just going out to the barn. Anyway, because you're kind of creating that roadway. The next person that goes out, if they have to forge their own path, then it's, you know, It should be easier each time going out. But anyway, I digress. Let's go ahead and pick up the next paragraph on page two.
Okay. It was proper to be considered also that the most important of the advantages would be better obtained by several banks properly distributed than by a single one. The aids to commerce could only be afforded at or very near the seat of the bank. The same was true of aids to merchants in the payment of customs. Anticipations of the government would also be most convenient at the different places. where the interest of the debt was to be paid. The case in America was different from that in England. The interest there was all due at one place, and the genius of the monarchy favored the concentration of wealth and influence at the metropolis.
In other words, the capital, the hub, the center of the monarchical theocracy, the monarchical government, which was London at the time, and still to this day. So go ahead, Sean. Let's pick up the next one.
It was proper to be considered also.
No. He thought the plan liable.
He thought the plan liable to other objections. It did not make so good a bargain for the public as was due to its interest. The charter to the Bank of England had been granted for 11 years only and was paid for by a loan to the government on terms better than could be elsewhere got. Every renewal of the charter had in like manner been purchased in some instances at a very high price. The same had been done by the banks of Genoa, Naples, and other like banks of circulation. The plan was unequal to the public creditors. It gave an undue preference to the holders of a particular denomination of the public debt and to those at and within reach of the seat of government. If the subscription should be rapid, the distant holders of paper would be excluded altogether.
Okay, so let's have a kind of an open discussion here. When you kind of look at what they're really doing, and we look at the fact that the Constitution empowered the government with these very specific powers to build, develop, a navy, and to do some very limited things. This sure seems like the federal government was now in the thralls of creating and operating a corporation, a bank, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
In other words, when we
for profit.
So you see this, Sean, right? I mean, this kind of starts jumping out that this becomes a huge focus of what the government, instead of just taking on debt, managing revenue, because for the most part, most households are pretty simple. You've got, what a friend of mine would call the gazintas and the gazautas, right? The things that come in and the things that go out. And so the things that come in are the paychecks. And the paychecks you divvy out to investment or what have you, but it's a pretty simple process. You pay off your debt, you pay your bills, and in other words, you're servicing, the household by paying your bills. And if you have debt, you pay those debt. And if you don't have debt, then that's great, because then you can invest, save, or what have you. But the point is that the way the federal government, we're running out of time here, and that's why I want to kind of conclude on this. The way the federal government was sold was it was not going to be bothered and be in its elbows deep into managing a commercial endeavor in bringing, these bank products out and selling them to the people and doing all of this business, which it was, anyway. I'll stop myself here because I have to get to that final, I'm G.R. Mobley. So, folks, we'll finish this off tomorrow. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.